Podcast, Wednesday, September 27th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your Maccast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the Maccast. Glad to have you back here with me for another episode. We have had quite a number of things go on since the last time we chatted. We're going to get into the release of the iPhone 8s and the new LTE Apple Watch. Those are out. Some of you may have those devices already and be playing with them. I received some feedback, actually, from some of you. I had a chance to go in and look at the products myself. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to get into some information and details that have come out since their release. Of course, we're also going to talk a little bit about the impending iPhone 10 release as well. Also, Apple TV 4K out in the wild, and we have more information about that, along with the updates to iOS, iOS 11. We've got more details on that. Updates on macOS High Sierra, which now has arrived as well. And we're going to talk about some updates Apple has recently made to its privacy website. So we've got all that in the news. We're also going to get to a little bit of feedback. Going to try and cover some iOS 11, macOS High Sierra tips and tricks, some new things that have come out. Also a follow-up on one of our listener issues where he was having some trouble with some music matched tracks in iCloud Music Library. We have some tips and feedback from one of our listeners on how to possibly resolve that issue. So we'll get into that. And then finally, I've got a great interview lined up for you with Peter Cohen. You may remember a while back, something that happened is we talked about backup, and specifically online backup as it relates to CrashPlan, which is shutting down its service. And Peter wrote a great article over on his blog about that. So we're going to interview him about that. And we also talk a little bit about a Mac Mini upgrade he did recently. So that will round out this episode of the MacCast. It should be a great show. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we jump in, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is MacPaw, and more specifically, their Clean My Mac 3 product. macOS High Sierra is here, as I mentioned, and if and when you get ready to upgrade, you probably want to make sure that you've got your old system all into shape and ready to go. And part of that process, at least for me, is clearing out any old file cruft, any extra OS system baggage that might be around. You know, we use our Macs every day, we're installing things, we're doing stuff, and just junk builds up in all kinds of different places, a lot of it in places that you're not even really in control of. And it can be difficult to go in there and try and figure out, you know, what in the system is safe to remove, what isn't. Well, with Clean My Mac 3, you don't have to worry about that stuff at all. I actually use Clean My Mac 3 regularly, every couple months or so, to help purge my Mac of extra system junk. And if you want, it can even remind you about stuff that you need to clear out. But I clear out my old system junk, any old cache files, app leftovers, you know, all those little bits and pieces that different apps leave behind, even when you try to uninstall them. And actually, Clean My Mac 3 has a great uninstaller built into it as well that will grab all of that stuff for you. And in fact, I have to tell you, it's become one of the essential utilities that I install on every one of my Macs on a regular basis. I am a huge fan. I love it. I prefer it over other utilities. There's lots of things that you can do to, you know, lots of little apps and things you can get that will do this kind of stuff. But what I love about Clean My Mac 3 is, one, the ease of use, two, the transparency. And what I mean by that is, it doesn't just go through and delete a bunch of stuff. It can if you want, but it leaves you in control. It keeps me in control, lets me see what it's going to be doing if I want, and allows me to override or decide or make decisions about what it's going to do and what it's going to clean up. It's got all kinds of great settings. They're easy to find. Nothing's hidden. And I really appreciate that about it. Also, you have all the tools you need in one application. You could kind of cobble together a lot of this stuff from different bits and pieces, and there's great apps out there for that. But having it all in one place and easy to use is a huge benefit, in my opinion. And, you know, I always have backups, and I always will, but I've never needed them with Clean My Mac 3. It's totally safe to use and does exactly what it advertises. So I absolutely love it. You do have a couple of options for getting Clean My Mac 3. It's available as a standalone version that you can get at cleanmymac.com, or also it comes as part of the equally awesome from MacPaw Set App subscription service, where you can get Clean My Mac along with over 90 other high profile applications, all for one low monthly subscription price. So whichever way you choose to get Clean My Mac 3, you are going to love it. You're going to love having a clutter-free and much faster running Macintosh. And a big thanks to MacPaw and Clean My Mac for their support of the show. The iPhone 8 and iPhone 8 Plus are now here. They have started shipping. The pre-orders went down, and you can also now probably go into your local Apple retail store and find one. Also, some of the third-party resellers. It doesn't seem like that we had the same kind of launch for the iPhone 8 as we have had for past iPhone launches, and that's a little bit to be expected because of the iPhone X. As a matter of fact, Ming-Chi Kuo, one of our favorite analysts, mentioned ahead of time that he expected that iPhone X demand was going to somewhat cannibalize iPhone 8 sales and iPhone 8 pre-orders, and that does appear to be what is happening. Now, the question is does that matter too much for Apple, and what is the severity? This is kind of a different launch for iPhone because there's a lot of different variables changing this time around. There were definitely no lines at Apple stores, at least not the huge ones that we've seen in the past. I saw some images and pictures and heard reports from some of you of very short lines. And there also didn't seem to be sellouts or shortages on the night that pre-orders were going on. And it's usually chaotic for most iPhone launches. But I think myself and a bunch of other early adopters, we're waiting for the iPhone X launch in October. And I think things will be very different for that launch. But as of right now, at least as far as I can tell, availability on most models and colors of the iPhone 8 and iPhone 8 Plus are good. Seems like the gold ones are maybe selling out a little bit more, but if you are in the market for an iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus, you're probably going to be able to get your hands on one. And really, when you think about it, it's just kind of the update. You know, it's really the iPhone 7S with a different name. Not that there's not a lot of nice enhancements in there, but you kind of get the point, right? And I have to say, they are great phones in terms of performance. We've been getting iPhone 8 benchmarking numbers, and as a matter of fact, in terms of raw Geekbench numbers, they are speccing out faster than a 13-inch MacBook Pro with a Core i5 processor. That is blazingly fast. And not that that means that much, right? Because I've said in the past, I don't really believe in benchmarking an iPhone versus a laptop. They're running different operating systems. They're used in the real world in very different ways. The point being is that these are high-performing computers, really. I mean, the iPhone 8, all recent iPhones actually are great computers in their own rights. But where it does make a difference is in real world applications. So exporting 4K video, for example, and we did get some tests from, I think this came from Tom's Hardware, that the iPhone 8 is literally smoking the competition when it comes to actually real world applications like 4K video exports. They did some tests and the iPhone 8 was able to export a 2-minute 4K video in about 42 seconds. Now compare that to some of the latest Samsung phones, the Galaxy Note 8 and the S8 Plus. They were able to do it in 3 minutes and 3 seconds and 4 minutes and 7 seconds respectively. They're not even in the same ballpark. Less than a minute versus 3 or 4 minutes with the competition. And that's just a testament to Apple's ability to tweak the performance, to be able to design their own processors and really optimize everything to make these really high performing phones. And that's why I think you're seeing a lot more content creation happening not only on iPads, but also on iPhones. You know, it's because of this performance and all the things that these devices can do. And Apple is certainly stepping up the game when it comes to other parts of the iPhone system, the cameras specifically. We also got reports from DxO Mark, and they gave the iPhone 8 Plus camera their highest rating ever for a camera phone. It gained an overall score in their rating system of 94. They evaluate the different smartphones and cameras on various things like exposure and contrast, gamma, color, autofocus, zoom, and flash, and they came away highly impressed with the iPhone 8 phone, the iPhone 8 Plus camera. And for comparison, the prior champion was not the iPhone 7 Plus. It had a mark of 88, but it was the Google Pixel and the HTC U11, which have both received pretty good reviews and responses for their cameras. DxO Mark gave them a score of about 90. So it's nice to see the iPhone coming out on top again. I'm going to be very curious to see how the iPhone 10 does. It should be even better than the iPhone 8 Plus with all of its great new features, including the dual optical image stabilization on the dual lens camera, the front-facing EyeSight camera. So I look forward to seeing those numbers. But overall, the iPhone 8 is getting really good reviews. People seem to really like it. I don't think it's all that surprising. It's just not selling, at least up front, in really high numbers. Still, a lot of the analysts aren't worried about it, especially Ming-Chi Kuo. He thinks it's going to be about a 50-50 split between people opting to go with the iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus, versus the iPhone 10. And we're going to talk about the iPhone 10 a little bit more a little bit later. As far as people getting them in their hands and what they're thinking about them, Apple has confirmed that some customers are having issues with their iPhone 8, hearing an intermittent crackling noise when they're taking phone calls. They are aware of the issue and they are working on a fix. If you have a new iPhone 8 or iPhone 8 Plus and you're experiencing this issue, until Apple issues that patch, the workaround is to either use headphones or the speakerphone option. That seems to bypass the problem, at least for now. So unfortunately, that little issue is there. But overall, we haven't heard of too many people complaining about their iPhone 8 or iPhone 8 Plus. Overall, I'm hearing, pretty good things. As far as my impressions on it, I was able to go into the Apple retail store and check out the new phones. Of course, one of the new changes is the wireless charging and the fact that the new design is using glass on both the front and back. And I have to tell you, as far as the new design goes, I think I like the older design better. It's not to say that the new design is bad, and I know there's a lot of people who prefer it, but my first reaction and impression when seeing the phones is when I flip them over, they're not really color matched front to back, or even with the stainless steel bands to the back. And that put me off a little bit. So for example, I think the space gray iPhone was my favorite color. It was the one that seemed to blend the best between the front and back. But even the black on there, or the space gray on there, was just a little bit more dull. It's kind of flat because what you have is glass on the back, but I believe they must either have some plastic material or paint. I don't know what is used to add the color to the glass, but basically you're looking through the glass layer at the color layer, and the glass is affecting the color underneath. So it's not the same sort of look. You get the kind of flat, opaque look to that color, and it works okay with the space black, but when you look at the silver model, it doesn't come across to me as being metallic or silver. What I'm kind of seeing is just a flat gray color, and it doesn't really match anything else on the phone, and to me that feels a little bit odd. And it's really different with the new gold color, the blush gold or that sort of copper gold. It looks great on the bands on the side, but when you flip it over, it's almost like just a warm white. And it almost makes me feel like, since it's white on the front, that I wish they would have just gone with a flat white on the back of both the silver model and the new gold model. I think it almost would have looked better if they just went white. So that was my initial reaction to it. As far as the phone itself and just using it, you know, fit and finish is spot on, as it always is with Apple products. It's a great device to hold. It has a nice weight to it. I think they're a little bit heavier than the prior generation models. I'd have to go back and check, double check the specs, but overall, great looking phones. I just wish they were a little bit better color matched it. And maybe some people like that kind of two-tone look, and I'm sure some of you will comment on that, but that was just my reaction to it. The only other thing that I really wanted to try out, I mean, as far as everything else goes, it works as expected. You've got that, you know, the virtual home button, or the home button that's not a home button. I don't know how to describe that. The one that's built right into the glass. It works as expected. Everything else, Touch ID, perfect. The phones are super fast. Everything glides smoothly. iOS 11 has a great look to it. So nothing unexpected there. I played around with the little cameras and the new portrait lighting mode. It's great. It works really, really well. I even tried to zoom in and kind of look at the masking and the edges, because some reviews had commented that, you know, the software is going to have a little bit of a hard time doing that. I thought it looked great. It was very hard to tell that it had done the effect, especially with the kind of theater spotlight mode. It looked great. So there was all of that. So then the only other thing that I really wanted to try out was the wireless charging. I wanted to see, you know, is it truly as easy as throw this down on a pad and it begins charging? And they did have out the Belkin charger. Apple doesn't have its charging mat ready to go yet. That's going to be coming sometime, hopefully before the end of the year, or maybe early next year. We don't really know. So they had the Belkin one out there, and you put it down and it starts charging as long as you have it perfectly aligned. And I played with this for several minutes when I was in the Apple store. So at first I tried putting it down, and they did have the little security button on the back, so that kind of made it harder to get the alignment just right. And the reps at the Apple store tried to imply that I was having issues because of that little button. But I have to tell you, when you got it in the right position, the button was there, and so the phone was actually lifted up just above the charger a hair, and it would connect. But it would only connect if it was perfectly centered on that pad. If I took it and just shifted it over, even just a millimeter, boom, it would disconnect. And certainly it was not as easy as just setting it on the pad, because if I tried to set it on the pad, just moved away from where the little security button was, nope, wouldn't connect. And I played with it over and over again. So at that point, I'm kind of feeling like I can't just throw my phone down on the wireless charger. And maybe it's just an issue with the Belkin charger. I wasn't able to test other chargers, so I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt there. But I'm feeling like it's just as easy to throw this in my charging dock where I connect it, as if every time that I go to put it on a charging pad, I'm going to have to make sure and double check, oh, is it charging? Is it in the right spot? Did it hit that perfect zone? So again, maybe it's a charger thing, but that was my first impression when I went into the Apple store and I tried out this, you know, new feature that everybody's been waiting for, wireless charging. And I'm not knocking it. I get it's great as an option. I'm just saying I don't think that with the added cost, because you've got to buy another charging base and all this other stuff, I think for some people they're going to love it. For me personally, I think it's a feature that I'm not probably going to take advantage of. And that's all I'm saying about it. And it's not to knock it. I think it's great that Apple added it in there. And I'm hoping that when Apple's charging pad ships, it's different, because their pad will allow you to ship, you know, to charge three devices at once. I think it uses a little bit different technology, maybe something that's a little bit better than some of the stuff that's currently on the market. I also know that there's different kinds of chargers. There's some that only have single coils and multiple coils. So a lot of this stuff could make a difference. So I'm going to reserve final judgment till I am able to actually test out and try more charging pads. But you get the idea. That was kind of my first impression. getting back to some other things, some other differences and changes with the iPhone 8, one is going to be repair costs. It's looking like it's going to be a little bit more costly if you have an accident with your new iPhone, iPhone 8 Plus, or even your iPhone 10 to get repairs done, even if you're on AppleCare. Now, if you have AppleCare Plus, the screen replacement cost is still going to be $29, but the back glass is not covered under the screen replacement cost. It's actually covered under the other accidental damage cost waiver, which is $99. So if you break that back glass, it's actually going to cost you more. Whereas in the past, I think damage to the back glass when we had phones that had dual glass, because I actually left one on top of my car, I think it cost me about $30 under AppleCare to get that replaced. So I don't know why the new glass is more, maybe because you've got the cameras embedded in there and sort of replacing it is a little bit more difficult. Apple did mention that they have this new hardened, they say the strongest glass that they've ever put into an iPhone. Maybe that factors into the cost a little bit, the fact that it's more technologically advanced. But as far as Apple's claim of it being the most durable glass they've ever put out, SquareTrade came in and did their drop tests. And unfortunately, the iPhone 8 and iPhone 8 Plus failed every drop test that they had. That meant the 3 foot, the 6 foot, didn't matter what angle, how they dropped it, every single time they dropped it, the glass cracked in some way or another. Sometimes more severe, sometimes less severe. But and I have to say, after kind of seeing that, I would recommend even people who typically like to run with a naked iPhone, you probably, if you're getting an iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus, and I would also assume an iPhone 10, that you're going to want to make sure you have a case on that thing. Otherwise, just be prepared. You might be paying a little bit more for screen replacements and more specifically back glass replacements. So there's that going on. Another little bit of disappointing news that came out regarding the iPhone 8S, 8S Plus, and the iPhone 10 is that if you are a T-Mobile customer, the modems in the phones are not going to be able to support the new LTE spectrum that T-Mobile acquired recently in an auction, and they're bringing online the 600 megahertz spectrum. That's the spectrum that's expected to help them get past some of the issues that T-Mobile seems to have with penetration and distance of their LTE, specifically when you go inside buildings. Some people have complained that, you know, if you're deep inside a building, the cell signal can have a hard time reaching you. This new 600 megahertz spectrum is supposed to help with that, but unfortunately, the modems in the iPhone 8 and iPhone 10 won't support that new band. Now, I don't think this is a huge deal breaker. It just basically means your current coverage with T-Mobile is going to remain the same. It would be nice if, as they brought that online, your new phone could support it, but it's probably going to have to wait till the next generation iPhone, iPhone 10 Plus or 11, whatever we're going to, 10S or 11, whatever they're going to be called. We don't know at this point. But just another thing to note. So not a big deal, but if you are on T-Mobile, something to be aware of. And I think that's kind of it for all of the updates on the iPhone 8s. Want to talk a little bit now about the Apple Watch and Watch OS 4. iFixit has been doing their teardowns of devices, and they did tear down an Apple Watch Series 3 to see what was different, and the answer was not a whole lot. It's almost identical to the Series 2 on the inside. It's got a slightly bigger battery for the LTE model, and they also did add an additional air vent, a little small mesh air vent right next to the diagnostic port, and that is because the new barometric altimeter is using the old vent location, which was the little hole right next to the microphone hole. So you've got one little extra hole in the Series 3, but beyond that, pretty much the same. And that's a pretty great feat for Apple. Of course, it's got the new LTE chip in there, but they fit it all in the same case design with the same thickness and everything else. So we didn't really expect to see too much different inside there. since the Series 3 LTE watches have hit the street, there has been a bit of information. Some people have reported an issue with moving between Wi-Fi networks, open Wi-Fi networks, and LTE. There seems to be a problem where sometimes the watch does not switch over to cellular. And what seems to be happening is that this occurs when you're connected to a previously known public Wi-Fi hotspot that has one of these interstitial logins. So if you've ever gone to a McDonald's or a Starbucks, you know, and you've got to approve that page that gets you on to the network, normally you do that through your iPhone. So with a Series 2 Apple Watch that doesn't have LTE, you would do that on the iPhone. You would also probably, the first time you went into one of these places, have to do that with your LTE Apple Watch. But if you're trying to run independently of your iPhone with just your watch, what can happen is the watch will be attempting to connect to the known Wi-Fi network. And the software is set up in a way where it says, hey, let's use open Wi-Fi before we use cellular. And that's obviously to save battery so they don't have to activate the cellular modem. But if it's on a Wi-Fi network with an interstitial page, obviously you have no internet connection. So it should be able to know to flop over to use the LTE at that point. It doesn't appear to be doing that. So that's kind of what the bug is. Tim Cook did come out in an interview recently and say Apple's aware of the issue and they will hopefully be issuing a fix soon. So I think one thing you can do is just simply disable the Wi-Fi on your Apple Watch, and that should force it over to the LTE connection if you've run into that issue for now. But Apple will be issuing a fix for that soon. So just be aware of that. Another thing that came out since the release of the Apple Watch Series 3 is that the Apple Watch Series 3 does not appear to work with the unlock feature if you are running macOS Sierra. If you try to do the Unlock My Mac feature with my Apple Watch and you have an Apple Watch Series 3, you're going to be met with a little message if you're running Sierra saying that you need to upgrade to the latest operating system. So it does, for some reason, require macOS High Sierra. Again, that's just with the Apple Watch Series 3. If you have a Series 2 or earlier, that feature should continue to work. I don't know why Apple made that a requirement. It seems odd to me, but now that macOS High Sierra is out, not that big of an issue. It was early on when you had a new Apple Watch Series 3 and you couldn't even upgrade to High Sierra. So you're going to have to do the upgrade if you want to get that feature back. Unfortunately, I'm not really recommending that everybody upgrades right away, so that may or may not be a problem for you. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about High Sierra. Another thing with watchOS 4 is the music app seems to no longer be able to browse your entire music library. Now you have only the ability to browse synced music, music that you have synced directly to the device. And I'm not really sure why this is happening either or why Apple decided to make this change. It does feel like they did it because of the LTE Apple Watch and the fact that you are going to be able to stream all of Apple Music to your Apple Watch. But that leaves those of us with, say, Apple Watch Series 2 or other devices that we've run through our phone in the past with a little less functionality than we had before. A little frustrating, but as far as I can tell, it doesn't look like that's going to be coming back. I'm going to give Apple some feedback at apple.com/feedback because I would like to see that feature come back. Hopefully, they'll listen to that and maybe it will. But for now, just be aware you're not going to be able to browse your entire music library from your Apple Watch. Apple made that change. Also, another little change that seems to be annoying some people, myself included, is that now when you're playing music on your iPhone, your Apple Watch will automatically switch over to the now playing screen. And this happens with a lot of different music applications that you might be running on your iPhone. So you get that interface, the now playing interface, taking over the Apple Watch face. So when you go to raise your wrist, that's what you're going to see if you have music playing. Now you can press the digital crown to get back to your standard watch face to say check the time or look at your complications. But once your watch goes back to sleep and you wake it up again, If you're still using that music application, it's going to switch back to the Now Playing app. Now, that may or may not be how you want things to work. Luckily, you can disable that feature. You can turn it off. If you go into the Watch application on your iPhone, go into General and look for the Wake screen options. Click on that and then tap on that, and you're going to toggle off the Auto Launch Audio Apps toggle. Once you've done that, Now Playing will not automatically come up. You're going to have to actually activate it manually from the app switcher or by going in and launching the music application from the app launcher. So that's how I've set mine up. I prefer to do it that way. Another cool new feature that is in watchOS 4 is you now have a flashlight on your Apple Watch. And not only that, you can get different modes and even a red color. So if you're a stargazer or something like that, you don't have to get the white light shift problem that you normally would with a standard flashlight. The way you get to the flashlight is you swipe up to bring up Control Center, click on the flashlight button, and then you can swipe left to get the different modes. It starts out with the white light mode. There's also a flashing mode and then the red color mode. Unfortunately, though, it does not remember the settings. So if you switched over to the red color and then you reactivate the flashlight later, you are going to get the white light, which is going to mess up the whole reason for using the red color light. So hopefully, again, Apple recognizes that this is a problem and makes the flashlight setting sticky in a future update. But we'll have to wait and see if they do that. Another thing that people have noted, a big new feature of the watchOS 4 update was the new heart rate data and sensor information, the ability to give you heart rate notifications and also show you your resting heart rate and do tracking of your resting heart rate and stuff like that. Unfortunately, it's looking like that is not available if you have an Apple Watch Series 0. So I just wanted to mention that in case you did the upgrade and were wondering why you weren't seeing those new features. You do need to have a Series 1, Series 2, or Series 3 Apple Watch. And then finally, wireless charging with third-party Qi chargers. That was a feature that was advertised for the Apple Watch Series 3. Now that those devices are out, people are testing it, and it looks like not all Qi chargers seem to support charging the Apple Watch Series 3. As near as they can tell at this point, we don't have an official word from Apple, but as near as reviewers can seem to make out at this point, you do need to get a Qi charger that supports charging multiple devices at the same time to get it to work with an Apple Watch Series 3. Again, that's if you're looking to buy a third-party charger. Of course, Apple's chargers work straight out of the box with Apple Watch Series 3. So that's kind of the latest of what we know about Apple Watch and watchOS 4. Let's talk a little bit more about iOS 11. I know we talked about it on the last episode of the MacCast, but we've got more information and details out now that it's hit the streets. Overall, I really am enjoying and like iOS 11, though a number of people in my audience and online seem to be reporting serious battery issues after doing the iOS 11 upgrade. Now, this is really weird in my opinion, because Apple had done extensive testing both with developers and in the public beta of iOS 11, and it doesn't seem to be until it actually hit the streets that people started reporting battery issues. For some reason, too, the reports that I'm getting, I've been noticing people are with iPhone 6S models. The 6S and 6S Plus seem to be more affected than any other users. I don't know why that is, or at least I'm getting more reports from owners of iPhone 6S and 6S Plus models. The other thing that I'm noticing is many of the reports seem to be inconsistent. Not everyone seems to be having the battery issues. There's a large percentage of people reporting issues, but I have also people saying, nope, battery's great for me. I'm not having any problems at all. And I counted myself in that group at first. I didn't think I was having any issues. And then I realized that, you know, I'm often near a charger, either in my car or sitting here at my desk. You know, I work from home. So I just casually, and not even when I'm noticing it, plug my phone in. So I made it a point one day after hearing these reports to make sure that I did not connect my iPhone. And sure enough, I was not able to get through the day with normal usage, and I'm not a heavy iPhone user, with normal usage, with consistent regular battery life that I was used to getting. By about midday, I was down to 50%, 40%, and before the end of the day, I was running out and feeling like I needed to get my phone to a charger ASAP. And there was even one weird moment where I was doing some stuff and my phone got incredibly hot just almost instantly, and I could watch the battery drop, the battery percentage, because as I was testing, I turned on the percentage and I could see it go right in front of my eyes down 2%. I rebooted my phone at that point, and that seemed to resolve the issue. It also cooled the phone down. So I don't know what triggered that or what was going on, whether it was some sort of app running amok, something like that. But something is going on here. There is definitely some fire to this smoke. Another thing I did notice, because I was trying to be more aware of my usage, was that, you know, I was testing out some new iOS 11 features. And I think some of the people reporting battery problems, it's because, you know, a new OS comes out and you want to play with everything. So you're launching more apps, you're kind of using your phone more heavily. So I am willing to say, let's wait a couple weeks, see if things calm down a little bit. But I still think something is going on here. And I can't tell, but Apple did issue iOS 11.0.1. And that may have helped the battery a little bit. But even today, I made a point of not connecting my phone, and I've been running iOS 11.0.1, and it does seem to be going down more quickly. I have also been having, and I don't know if this is related or not, I'm mainly mentioning it to find out if any of you are having the same issue, but I've been having a strange wake issue a couple of times. I would say three or four times since upgrading to iOS 11. I have pressed the sleep wake button on my iPhone, and then a minute or two later, gone back to use the phone, and the raise to wake feature doesn't come on. And when I press the sleep wake button, nothing happens. And I can press it multiple times, and then maybe 30 seconds, 40 seconds later, the screen starts flickering. And what I think's happening is it's registering the number of times that I press the sleep wake button. It's almost like it's on a delay. And then it will eventually wake back up. One time I actually had to hard reboot it to get things back to normal. So I don't know if that's just my phone or something with iOS 11. But if you've been having that issue, let me know. Maccast@gmail.com. Otherwise, I think I may have a trip to the Genius Bar in my future to figure out what's going on with my phone. If you are having general battery issues with iOS 11, again, I think this may be a problem that Apple needs to address with software, but there are some things that you can check that can maybe help you get through this period to get a little bit better battery life. And I just wanted to point some of these out. So one of the things would be just check the battery, go into settings, go into the battery settings and see which apps are using the most battery. The battery screen will also show you which apps are running with background activity, so which ones might be using a little bit more battery than others. See if there's a serious offender in there. You might find that one app is using up a large percentage of your battery, and maybe you want to tweak its settings, or maybe if it's not a critical application, you might want to stop using it or make sure that it's not running in the background. So do that. Another huge one to check is which applications are allowed to do a background app refresh. I know that when I went into settings, general, background app refresh, and I looked at the list, every single one of my apps was toggled on. I think I had never gone in and sort of adjusted that setting. Obviously, many of my applications, I don't need updating their data in the background. Some of them, like mail and things like that, my mail client and things like that, I want to be able to do that. But tweaking those settings could help you out quite a bit when it comes to battery, because, you know, things you don't, you, there are apps you probably don't need to go out to the internet and update their data. And that's really what background app refresh is about. It's about being able to launch the app and have fresh data there right away without connecting to the internet. If you can wait a few moments for an app to actually go out and refresh its data, then turn that off. Don't have it in background app refresh. Location services using the GPS is another big battery drain, so you might want to restrict which applications have access to location services, specifically always on location services. So if you go into settings, privacy, and under location services, you can look at the settings there. Generally, what I look for is the applications that have the little purple or gray arrow icon. That means that that application has recently used location at some point, whether you've launched the app or it's happening in the background. And I always should check to see which apps really need to be set to always. And if it's set to always, that means that even when you're not using or running the app, it could be using location services. So I tend to favor setting that to either never for a lot of applications or while using the app. So certain apps like Yelp, for example, it doesn't need to be, for me, it doesn't need to be checking and running my background location services all of the time. I'm happy to let it connect and do that when I launch the application. So tweak that setting and that might help your battery out a little bit. You can also check your fetching for mail settings. If you go into settings, accounts, and passwords, fetch new data, you might want to toggle that push option to be completely off, or if you prefer, go in and tweak the settings for individual mail accounts. Maybe you have some critical business mail accounts that you do want to be able to push new mail data to, but you know, something else, some of your personal accounts, hey, you can have that just go out and fetch new emails, say every 15 minutes or 30 minutes or every hour, or maybe even you want to do it manually, and that is going to help save on your battery a little bit. You can also lower or adjust your screen brightness settings, going into settings, display and brightness, and also in that same area, check on your auto lock. If you can have your phone go into auto lock mode a little bit more quickly, that can save on some of your battery life as well. And then finally, if you are having battery issues, you're getting near the end of the day and maybe you're at 20% or something like that, you can go in and enable the low power mode option. If you go into settings, battery, there's a little toggle for low power mode, and that's basically going to turn off a bunch of things like background app refresh for all of your applications temporarily so that you can maybe get a little extra juice out of it toward the end of the day. You can also add the toggle to low power setting in Control Center. Now that Control Center, you can completely customize what's in there. If you go into Settings, Control Center, click on Customize or tap on Customize and then tap the little plus icon next to low power mode, you can put that setting right into Control Center to make that easier to access. So if you are getting to the end of the day and you need to toggle that on real quickly, you can do that very simply and easily from Control Center. So just some things to deal with battery life issues, but overall, I hope that at some point Apple addresses this problem with iOS 11. Another thing to note and something that came out about iOS 11 that's a little bit different, toggling Wi-Fi and Bluetooth using Control Center, it turns out, does not fully disable them. And I don't know if this is just in iOS 11 or just something that we're just noticing with iOS 11. According to Apple's support article, though, this is not a bug. This is actually by design. What it does when you toggle those now in Control Center is it disconnects your devices and connections, but it leaves the radios themselves, both the Bluetooth and the Wi-Fi radios, on so that they can be used for features like AirDrop, AirPlay, Handoff, Instant Hotspot, your Apple Pencil, Apple Watch, and location services. So it's just going to disconnect like third-party devices when you toggle the Bluetooth. It does disable the auto join feature for nearby Wi-Fi networks until a couple of different events happen. One, you turn it back on in Control Center, or if you manually connect to a Wi-Fi network in Settings Wi-Fi. If you walk or drive to a new location, so with a new Wi-Fi hotspot, this one's interesting. If it gets to be 5 a.m. local time, I guess this automatically resets as well. It'll automatically turn your Wi-Fi back on, or if you restart your device. And it's very similar for the Bluetooth connectivity. You won't be able to connect any new accessories until you turn Bluetooth back on in Control Center. You connect to a Bluetooth accessory in Settings Bluetooth. It's 5 a.m. local time or you restart your device. So just be aware of that. If you toggle it off in Control Center, it is going to leave the antennas on. And again, that's a factor that comes into, I guess, battery usage and battery life and just something to be aware of. Many people have also noted with iOS 11 that Messages in the Cloud is not here yet. That was something that Apple advertised at Worldwide Developer Conference. It didn't make the cut for the first release of iOS 11. Apple is still working on it. It's expected to come in the future, but it's not here yet. So if you've been wondering why your messages on your iPhone are not syncing up with your messages on your iPad, that's what's going on there. Another feature that seems to be gone in iOS 11 is the whole 3D Touch app switcher. That's where you force press on the edge of the screen and swipe across to bring up the app switcher. Craig Federighi said that is coming back in a future update to iOS 11. So if that is a feature that you enjoyed, don't worry, it will be coming back. If you can't wait, I received a tip from a listener that I thought was pretty handy. You could set up and use a feature, an accessibility feature in iOS called Assistive Touch to actually activate the app switcher in a fashion similar to the 3D Touch option. If you go into Settings, General, Accessibility, and then tap on Assistive Touch, what you can do is you can go to the Customize Top Level Menu option, and you can set the 3D Touch action to be multitasking on the Assistive Touch button. Then you want to turn on Assistive Touch, so there's a toggle in there for that. And what that will give you is this little virtual white button. That's the Assistive Touch button that is always on your screen. And now if you force press that virtual button because you've set the 3D Touch action to multitasking, it should activate iOS multitasking. And you can actually press and hold and drag the Assistive Touch icon anywhere you want it on the screen, and it will stay there. So if you drag it over to the left-hand edge, kind of in the center, you can kind of simulate the 3D Touch app switcher. And I thought that was a great little workaround, at least until Apple brings that feature back. Another very cool new feature in iOS 11 is Apple's new high-efficiency image file format, HEIF, and their high-efficiency video codec, HEVC. Both of these things are new codecs designed to help save you space, give you higher quality images, higher quality video in smaller storage sizes, so they're not taking up all that room on your phone. And a lot of people were concerned about these and compatibility. What will happen when I'm shooting in high efficiency image format, and then I want to take that photo to another application, or I want to share it with a friend who's maybe on a PC? Well, you don't need to worry about that, because when you activate the share sheet options in iOS, it's going to automatically transcode that either into JPEG or standard H.264 format. The high efficiency video coding is actually H.265, which is a newer standard, and more things are going to be supporting that, but for now, it's new in iOS 11. If you don't want to have those new high efficiency formats, you can actually turn them off in the camera settings. So if you go into Settings, Camera, and click on the Formats option, you will see you have options for high efficiency or most compatible. If you set it on most compatible, it's going to default back to JPEG and H.264. The deal is, though, that HEIF and HEVC can potentially give you higher quality images at about half the storage cost. So I would say it's probably worth giving them a try, leaving that option on, using your iPhone, and see if it gives you any trouble when you're interacting with third-party apps or sharing your images and stuff like that. My guess is that you're really not going to notice it. And to have that much file savings, especially for images and videos, which tend to be the largest consumers of storage, at least for me on my iPhone, I'm looking forward to those new high efficiency formats. Another interesting thing that came up this week, Apple has switched the Spotlight and Siri searches over from Bing back to Google now. They're also going to be doing this for Spotlight searches on the Mac in Mac OS High Sierra. Bing is going to continue to be the web image search for iOS, but everything else is now back to Google. So if you are a Google fan and you're doing a Spotlight or a Siri search on your iOS device, you're going to notice, hey, it's Google results again. So I'm pretty happy about that. Bing was never a problem for me, but I just prefer Google. So I think that's great. And as I mentioned earlier, iOS 11.0.1 update is already out. We don't have a lot of details about what's in there other than it has some bug fixes and performance improvements. So if you've been having little issues since running iOS 11.0, you probably want to grab the update, which is out now and should be available in your software update. So that's all the latest with iOS 11. Apple TV 4K. I had a chance to actually play around and look at that in the Apple Store as well. It was pretty neat, although what I did notice was that Apple's display televisions were set to standard definition instead of high definition. I'm not really sure what that was all about. And I went into the settings and I played around and I tweaked with it a little bit in the Apple Store, put it on HDR, and it would switch over to HDR. But in my opinion, the images actually didn't look as good as the standard definition. So I don't know if that was the television. I'm not a TV guy. I don't know much about 4K and HDR 4K and all this stuff, but I'd be curious to hear from you. Did I miss something there, or what's going on? Why is Apple not showing off HDR on the Apple TVs in store? Maybe I'm just confusing the terms or something like that. But the Apple TV did get a teardown from iFixit. It shows some interesting new changes with the latest Apple TV. It now has 3 gigabytes of RAM versus the 2 that was in the Apple TV 4th generation, right? There's a new power supply that has slightly more amps, and a new fan and cooling design, and the fan is actually replaceable. So it got a little bit better repairability score from iFixit. It's still not a easy to get into and repair device, but a couple little changes there that were nice. And we already did know that Apple had brought back the gigabit Ethernet port and that they no longer have the USB-C diagnostic port, because you're able to actually do that functionality now wirelessly, which is nice, and I think we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast. Something to be aware of: while Apple's new 4K Apple TV does support the Dolby 10 HDR, apparently it doesn't support Dolby's latest high-quality Atmos audio, which some reviewers have been very disappointed by, especially considering that some other devices on the market, the Roku and now Amazon's new Fire TV, do support that. Now, Apple has said it is going to be adding that support sometime in the future, but out of the box right now, it's not in there. So if that's something that you care about, you might want to just hold off on your Apple TV 4K purchase, or know that that is coming later. Another thing that was almost immediately noted by reviewers is that YouTube, the YouTube app on the Apple TV 4K, cannot show 4K YouTube content right now, and that is because the Apple TV is not supporting Google's open source VP9 video format, which is how they distribute currently their 4K content. Now, when and if Apple will add support for that, or if Google will tweak their offering on iOS to give 4K in a different format, is unknown. That's going to be a battle that goes on between Apple and Google, and they've been fighting that format war. You know, Apple is H.265, Google is VP9, so we're going to have to wait and see how that pans out. Hopefully, one of those companies gives in. I'm hoping that it's Apple, that they just support Google's video codec, but and that may be unlikely. We'll just have to wait and see. But just be aware, you're not going to be able to get 4K YouTube content on your new Apple TV 4K, at least not for now. And as far as 4K content from iTunes, iTunes does have 4K video rentals and movie downloads, and you are getting some upgrades as it gets converted. You know, different things that you've purchased have been converted to 4K. You are going to get free upgrades of that content, but it's looking like 4K is available for streaming only. If you're going to download your content either to iTunes or to the device itself, you're going to still get the 1080p HD format. This could potentially be an issue for folks who have a monthly data cap from their ISP because you're going to have to stream. And if you want to do multiple viewings, you're going to be streaming a lot more, using a lot more of your bandwidth, because you're not going to be able to just download that, have that locally, and then, you know, once, and then watch it locally there. You're going to have to stream it every single time. As far as why that is, it looks like it's not, you know, the licensing deal that Apple did. Really what's probably happening is the studios are concerned about piracy of high-quality 4K content, and they're wanting to protect it by only allowing you to stream it. That's just speculation on my part. I don't really know. We don't have details about what the deals are, but that seems logical to me. So just be aware of that. Some good news, though, if you like renting movies from iTunes, looks like movie rentals are now have a 48-hour viewing window instead of 24 hours. You still have 30 days to start watching your rental, but now you have a full 48 hours to finish watching it from the point that you start. And that's been a long time coming. I think other services have had that window for a while. Glad to see that Apple now is in that same boat. And we also finally have some more signs that Apple means business when it comes to its original content efforts. The Hollywood Reporter is citing multiple sources who say that Apple is shopping for a Game of Thrones or Breaking Bad style drama. They're looking for a really high impact, really high quality drama to launch on their original content service. Insiders are saying that Apple's team of ex-Sony TV executives have already approached talent, including Vince Gillian, Bryan Cranston, and The Outlander's Ron Moore, so some pretty top-tier talent, and they seem to be doing a lot more recruiting and talking around. The report also says that the company has bids out on a handful of projects, including a update of Steven Spielberg's 1980 sci-fi horror and fantasy series Amazing Stories, and that would be awesome. I loved that as a kid. It was kind of like Steven Spielberg's take, I always felt, on like the Twilight Zone. Each episode kind of had a great sci-fi horror fantasy kind of story, original story, and I always felt that they were really well done. Now I've gone back and watched some of that stuff on streaming, and yeah, perspective falls into that, but I think that could make a great original content TV show, and if Apple can pick up something like that, especially with Steven Spielberg behind it, that would be amazing. And Apple reportedly has set aside this $1 billion budget for acquiring new shows, so I think they could pull off some pretty cool stuff. And we're just going to have to wait and see. They also recently posted a job listing for a video partnerships lead, someone that would be responsible for negotiating with content providers like TV networks and movie studios, again, with the goal of expanding Apple's video offerings and video services. So Apple is getting into this stuff. When and if all of it comes to fruition and how they're going to roll it out, we really don't know at this point. But they're working hard, it looks like, to kind of step up and I think ultimately compete with services like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, at least when it comes to original content. And I'm looking forward to seeing what Apple puts together. I'm just hoping that it doesn't detract too much from their core businesses. I think it's a big part of them expanding their services, which is the largest growing portion of their business. So I think it makes sense for them to invest in this area. And they seem to be doing it the right way by forming almost a completely separate division that's kind of controlling that. Whether or not that's going to at some point have to get split out into a whole separate company, I think that could be something that might need to happen and maybe should happen. So again, their core products doesn't get, you know, taken away from by some of these other efforts, something that I feel really happened to Sony as a company in the 80s, and they kind of lost their lead in the consumer electronics space, and I'd hate to see that happen to Apple. And this is something that I talked about and was concerned about maybe 10 years ago on the MacCast, if you go back and listen to those episodes. And it just seems like we could be moving down that trajectory, and I'd hate to see that happen. All right, macOS High Sierra has also hit the streets, and I just have a couple comments about that. One, if you're thinking about upgrading, think about it. Think about it a little bit longer. If you have a mission-critical machine, something that you rely on daily for your work, I urge you, wait a couple weeks. Don't be an early adopter. Let others kind of take the fall, figure out where the bugs and bumps and issues are. You don't want to be going through that when you're in the middle of trying to deliver a product or work with a client or whatever it might be. So, you know, there's no harm in waiting. You don't have to upgrade day one. And especially with macOS High Sierra, it's mostly an under the hood performance update. There's not a lot of big new features that you're probably going to want to have to rush to tap into. So hesitate a little bit. There's nothing wrong with that. And I'm probably going to be waiting a month or two before I actually upgrade my main machine. Another thing to do before you upgrade is check and make sure that all of your mission critical apps are going to work with the new operating system. Again, not a lot shouldn't work, but there are some things. And as a matter of fact, Apple World Today, our friend Steve Sandy compiled a great list of apps that they found that are not High Sierra ready or are having maybe minor issues that you could potentially work around on High Sierra. And some of the apps in that list, at least for a lot of podcasters I know, are going to be mission critical: Audio Hijack and Loopback from Rogue Amoeba. They're working very hard on getting their stuff ready, but there's little stuff in there that you might want to be aware of. I think they have some betas out and things that you can try. Super Duper, if you rely on that for your clone backup, they do have a beta available that it should work with High Sierra, but the main application isn't. A surprising one that was on Steve's list that I'm not really sure why this isn't working, but Adobe Illustrator Creative Cloud 2017. Yeah, that's a big one. Some of you actually know have this application, although I think you should upgrade at this point. Office 2004, a lot of people have stuck with that for, I guess, 10 years, you know, 13 years now. So it's probably time to upgrade that one, but it's not going to work on macOS High Sierra. FileMaker is a biggie on that list. Google Drive, Onyx, and even one of my favorite new note-taking applications, Bear. In their case, it's just a small theme bug, and I think they may have issued a patch for it already. But these are the kinds of things that you want to check, right? You want to do this before you upgrade. You don't want to upgrade and then find out later that critical application isn't working for you. So make sure you do that. Obviously, before you upgrade, I'm going to tell you backup, backup, backup. Check your backups. Make sure if you have bootable clone backups that those are working, you can boot from them, that you can recover files from them before you upgrade. I know it's a little extra time, but do that due diligence, because if you need to roll back, you don't want to find out then that your backup is got an issue or isn't working. And I would say after you upgrade, if you can keep around one of your cloned backups or a Time Machine backup on an extra drive, I prefer to do that. That way, if you get a week in and you find a mission critical problem, hey, you have something you can immediately go back to. And I tend to keep one of my cloned backups around for about a month after I upgrade, just to make sure that I didn't miss anything. And I generally do that again if I'm going to do a clean install. And that leaves me with the final question before you upgrade. Are you going to do an over-the-top install or a clean install? And all I can say about that is it really depends on your situation. This day and age, I think most of the time for most people, you can get away with just running the updater, installing right over the top of what you have. The one exception to that I will give you is if you know you're having existing problems with your current installation. You're seeing a lot of beach balls, you're having crashes, you're having weird, odd issues. And I'm actually in this boat with my machine. I have all kinds of weird stuff happening where certain drives will disconnect. I'm having this weird little icon problem where I'll launch something in my dock and suddenly it switches to a generic icon. I don't know what that's all about. I'm having bugs and issues with my Sierra installation. So I know already I don't want to install right over top of that because I don't want to bring that baggage along. So I'm going to be doing a clean install. I've covered this on the MacCast in the past. I'm not going to cover it in this episode, but once I do my clean install, I probably will go through that whole procedure again. But it basically involves, in a nutshell, the basic steps are backup, 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 make sure I have good working backups, then do a erase of my internal main hard drive on my Mac, install a clean installation of macOS High Sierra, And then I do a restore from backup. You know, I do the migration, but I only bring over my user account and my network settings. All of my applications I reinstall one by one from scratch. And it, yes, it's very time consuming, but that has worked for me very well in the past. So that's kind of the basics of it. There's some more details in there, but you get the idea. So clean install versus over the top, it's really going to be up to your current situation. Of course, one of the big, huge changes with Mac OS High Sierra that's under the hood is the new file system, Apple moving from HFS Plus to Apple File System. If the boot drive on your Mac is a solid state drive, if you have flash storage, it's going to be converted to Apple File System automatically. You're not going to have a choice to opt in or opt out of that. Overall, from what I've been hearing from people who've done the upgrade, you should be fine. There doesn't seem to be any issues. You just need to be aware that that change is happening. If you have a Fusion Drive Mac or one that has a traditional hard drive as the main boot drive, those will not be converted. And as a matter of fact, APFS right now is not supported on Fusion drives. So that will eventually be coming, but at this point, it's not. Also be aware that if you have a Time Machine drive, that is not converted and should not be converted. You do not want to run Apple File System on Time Machine drives at this point. Just because of how Time Machine works, it's not really supported. It will probably come again with a future update, but for right now, don't do that. I also read a blog post by Drobo. Your Drobos should work fine with the new file system, but the Drobos themselves you want to keep on HFS Plus. You do not want to reformat those, and as a matter of fact, you should only be formatting your Drobos from the Drobo dashboard application, never using the built-in utilities on macOS. At least that's what's recommended from Drobo. So be aware of all of that when it comes to the file system. And the file system is the number one area where you might run into or find applications that are having issues, you know, so backup applications and things like that. So you're going to want to check on those applications before you upgrade to make sure that they support macOS High Sierra and the new APFS file format. One bit of good news with the macOS High Sierra upgrade is I've been getting reports from a number of people, and I've read online in a number of places, that older Macs are kind of gaining new life. They're actually speeding up and running faster with the upgrade to macOS High Sierra. Now, I don't know if this is due to the new APFS file system, which should be faster if you're running, again, a system that uses an SSD drive. That could be part of it, or it could also just be general under the hood tweaks, enhancements, and improvements. But whatever the reason, there are multiple reports of people saying, yeah, my Mac is actually running faster, I'm seeing less speech balls and stuff since upgrading to macOS High Sierra. So that might be one compelling reason to maybe go through the upgrade if you're ready to do that. And one last thing with relation to macOS High Sierra, NVIDIA did release their drivers for macOS High Sierra to support their PCIe graphics cards, their drivers for the Quadro and GeForce Pascal-based models. So if you have those cards, especially if you have a legacy Mac Pro running those and you want to run High Sierra, those drivers should be available to you. And also they released beta drivers for the Thunderbolt 3 eGPU setups. So if you're going to use an external enclosure with the 5K iMac or the new MacBook Pros, those drivers are available for you as well. So that's great news for Pro Mac customers. And I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of that. So that's all the latest with macOS High Sierra. Now let's talk a little bit about the future of iPhone X. Supplies are looking like they're going to be more constrained than ever. I know we've been talking about this in the lead up to the iPhone X release, but there are looming indications that those of us who are holding out for the higher end models, there's a lot of us, first of all, and the supply chain is saying, yeah, components are slow in arriving. Apple is trying to assemble as many iPhones as they can for the launch. But right now, at least according to DigiTimes, they're saying that many suppliers are only shipping about 40% of the components that were originally planned for the initial production launch of the iPhone X. There is speculation that that may be a coordinated effort by Apple, that Apple was kind of saying, okay, to their saying to their suppliers, let's wait, let's see how iPhone 8 and iPhone 8 Plus orders are going, how many people are ordering those. That'll help us gauge demand for iPhone 10 pre, and we also want to take a look at iPhone 10 pre-orders. We don't want to have too many phones ready to go. Just get ready to ramp up immediately after iPhone 10 goes into pre-order, and we'll kind of figure out that. So Apple's trying to do this just in time, figuring out how many, you know, phones they're actually going to need ready to go. And as a matter of fact, Ming-Chi Kuo said that iPhone 10 production could be totaling as few as 10,000 units per day at this point, but he does expect pre-orders to possibly exceed 40 to 50 million units in, I believe, the first year, you know, this between now and the end of the year for iPhone sales. So iPhone 10 demand looking to be huge, supply looking to be constrained. Put those two things together, and that translates to you and I, hey, it's going to be hard to get an iPhone 10. Not that we didn't already know that. And a lot of the reports are saying a big part of the component problem is all of those sensors that Apple needs for the true depth camera system. That is a big source of the bottleneck. As a matter of fact, the Wall Street Journal was reporting that part of the problem is an imbalance between the number of the dot projector modules. If you remember, that system has this projector that puts 30,000 dots on your face to use, to, you know, to activate the Face ID feature. And then that gets picked up by an infrared camera module in the phone. The infrared camera modules, which reportedly have been dubbed Romeo, those are in good supply, but the companion dot projector, which has been dubbed Juliet, those are having production problems, and they're slow in coming, so they don't have the matched sensors. And of course, you have to have the same number of Romeo modules and Juliet modules together to actually produce a true depth camera system, so that causing a little bit of the delay. And then finally, with respect to the iPhone X, a filing with the Chinese Ministry of Industry and Information Technologies Telecommunication Equipment Certification Center. Wow, that is a long title. Those guys have actually inadvertently, or I guess because of their requirements, revealed some of the technical details that we didn't know behind the iPhone X, specifically the size of the battery and how much RAM. The battery, it looks like, is going to be a 2,716 milliamp hour battery, and it is confirmed that the iPhone X will have 3 gigabytes of RAM, just like the iPhone 8 Plus. That last stat, I don't think, was too much of a surprise. As far as how the battery compares to Apple's current phones, it's just slightly bigger than the iPhone 8 Plus, which comes in at 2,691 milliamp hours. The iPhone 8 actually has a smaller battery than the iPhone 7, just slightly, and is only 1,821 milliamp hours. So that battery in the iPhone X, even though it's the same size physically as the iPhone 8, is much, much larger, almost the same size battery as the, a larger battery than the iPhone 8 Plus. And it's assumed that extra capacity is needed for the true depth camera and the dual lens camera system. Both of those power hungry sensors, and the display, you know, that is OLED, so it should actually be more energy efficient. So the fact that it needs all that extra juice probably has to do with the camera systems. But that's some of the latest on the iPhone X. And then finally, in the news for this week, it looks like Apple has updated their privacy website. They've revamped it to reaffirm their commitment to our privacy. They've made it easier to understand some of the technology and steps that they're taking to help protect our information. It explains a lot of their underlying policies for systems like passcodes, Touch ID, Apple Pay, and app permissions. One cool thing that you might want to check out on the new privacy website is there's also a link to a Face ID white paper that lays out a lot of the details about how and when Face ID is used, and also how Apple limits the diagnostic sharing of information related to Face ID. So if you're curious about all that stuff, there is a PDF that you can download and read on that website. Another one of the big areas that's highlighted on the privacy website is Apple's policy with regards to their use of differential privacy. Now, you may remember this is how Apple is going to be able to collect some analytic data about usage patterns and things that we do on our phones, but still protect our individual identities. The whole idea behind this is that when they collect data, they would not be able to actually use that information and data in aggregate and backtrace that back to discover the identity of a individual person. And the way they do that is they take the data that they collect and then they also inject other false data or noise into that before it gets sent over to Apple. Now, the noise and false data information doesn't impact the usefulness of the data, but it is supposed to be enough to mask the individual identity. So you shouldn't be able to look at that data and figure out who that data individually belongs to. That's the whole concept, or in a nutshell, in a basic mode, how differential privacy is supposed to work. Now, unfortunately, Apple recently got called to task over how they're implementing that. And a number of security researchers have said, hey, it's not good enough. This came out in a piece from Wired magazine. And it was done by, the findings were made by researchers from the University of Southern California, Indiana University, and a university in China. And I'm not even going to attempt to say the name because I'm sure I'm going to mutilate it. But they basically concluded that Apple's implementation is really not that great at protecting individual identities, at least when it comes to the field of differential privacy. Now, what I know about this too is that differential privacy experts, even in those in their circles, they kind of disagree in some ways about the implementation. But what's going on here is it all goes back to this idea about the noise and can you backtrace the information in aggregate back to an individual. And according to the Wired piece, everything is predicated, or the measurement of how effective differential privacy is predicated on this value called the epsilon value. And an ideal value for epsilon would be 1, and lower numbers are better. Any number above 1, they say, actually puts data privacy at risk. So when they ran this study, when these researchers ran this study, Apple doesn't provide its actual methods for achieving differential privacy. It's actually a fact that, you know, one of the factors that researchers have issue with is that because they don't know how Apple is implementing the differential privacy, they really can't accurately evaluate how good or bad it might be. Now, what these researchers did is they spent many months kind of reverse engineering what Apple was doing with the data and the kinds of data it was sending back and forth. So they looked at the information flowing out of your iPhone and how the data was impacted, and they tried to reverse engineer and best figure out what Apple was doing. And what they concluded was that iOS's implementation of differential privacy had an epsilon value of about 6. Now, remember, 1 is ideal, and they're saying anything above 1 means that you could eventually figure out, given enough data, you could get past the differential privacy. And macOS had an epsilon of 6, not iOS, and iOS had an epsilon of about 14. Now, Frank McSherry, one of the inventors of differential privacy, said that using an epsilon value of 14 per day strikes him as relatively pointless. So there's almost, if that's the epsilon value, he's saying there's even no point in having the differential privacy. And he gave an example. He said that someone who has a 1 in a million medical condition uploading data from the health app, after one upload of obfuscated data with injection of random data, so differential privacy applied to it, he says data analysts could figure out within a 50% certainty who that person was or which person had that condition. And he said after 2 days of uploads of that data, analysts would know without a doubt, virtually with 100% certainty, who had that medical condition. And so that basically says, you know, the differential privacy doesn't work at that point. Now, Apple disputes the researchers' findings, noting that they don't correlate different kinds of data together the way that these researchers are implying. And they also pointed out that Apple doesn't build profiles over time. So that's not a factor. They actually limit the storage of the data. So the data is just not going to be available to kind of aggregate together to backtrace, to figure out who it belongs to. And that makes overtime correlation impossible, according to Apple. And they also say that they throw out unique identifiers like IP addresses. So that can't be factored into calculations. But still, the researchers take issue with the fact that on this point, we just need to trust Apple, and that Apple is not providing pure mathematical guarantees. And the fact that they don't do that misses the whole point of differential privacy, at least according to them. So there's a little bit of a he said, she said going on. As far as what it means to you and I, you know, we have to decide, do we trust Apple on this point? Now, Apple is saying that this data is protected. They're protecting our privacy. And frankly, I tend to believe them. I think they have no interest in trying to backtrace or figure out who this data belongs to individually. Now, whether they could be compelled by law enforcement at some point to kind of do some of this stuff or provide different amounts of data, that's where it gets a little bit murky, and that's where certain people may be concerned about what Apple is doing. Apple does note that you actually have to opt into their data collection, and that is true. Anybody who's set up an iPhone or a Mac, you know this. You get asked the question, do you want to send analytical data to Apple? Now, unfortunately, I think most people just agree. They just say, oh, that's not a problem, go ahead. And they may not realize what they're agreeing to. So you can actually check these settings on your Mac or your iOS device, and you can turn it off completely if you just don't want Apple to have any of the data. And then that gets rid of any concern, right? You're in control, so you can turn it off. So in iOS, if you go into settings, go into privacy, scroll down to analytics, just switch off the option that says share iPhone and watch analytics data. Toggle that to off, and you won't be sending any of that data to Apple. On the Mac, it's a similar system. Go into system preferences, security and privacy, click on the privacy tab, then click on analytics from the side menu, and then turn off share any of the share analytics toggles. You may actually need to click the little lock icon and enter your admin credentials before you can make the change, but that's how you toggle it off on the Mac. And if you turn all that off, differential privacy or not, Apple is not going to have your data. So that's the latest of all of the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of PDF Pen, actually the entire PDF Pen family. It will let you edit PDFs like a pro, either on your Mac or on your iPhone. You can check out the whole suite of applications, PDF Pen for Mac OS, PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. It gives you a complete paperless workflow. I am a huge fan of PDF Pen. I have it installed on every Mac, every device, and I use all of it because it really is like a Swiss Army knife for dealing with PDFs. If you want to do some quick PDF editing, if you want to do annotations, if you need to add a signature to a PDF, it can all be done with PDF Pen on whatever device you want. And it all syncs through cloud services. So anything you have in one device shows up on your Mac, and you can work with it wherever you want. It's handy and convenient. PDF Pen Scan Plus makes it real easy to work with your digital workflow, paperless workflows. You can just scan any document right into PDF Pen Scan Plus. It does OCR on that, so you have immediate access to searching, and you can do that again from your desktop or your iOS device because it all syncs over. Great for scanning in receipts if you're using that for your business. And really, then you have it in PDF pen. If you need to print something off, if you need to sign something, send it off in an email. You can do it quickly and easily. You can even add text and graphics, a whole lot more. You can check out all of the stuff that you can do with PDF pen and get information on all of Smile's great products by going to smilesoftware.com/maccast. Get all of the details there. And if you don't have PDF pen, if you've never checked it out, download the free trial. Try it out. It is an amazing application. I can't say anything more highly about it. I love it. I use it all the time. So check it out, smilesoftware.com/maccast. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the show. All right, we're running a little bit long. I want to get to my interview with Peter Cohen, but I've got a couple quick things to talk to you about, follow up on from previous shows, starting off with a couple real quick tips and tricks for iOS 11 and Mac OS High Sierra. I discovered a really cool feature with messages, and specifically SMS. I hate junk text messages, but unfortunately, they are becoming more and more part of our lives. So I love this great new feature in iOS 11. You can now segregate and separate SMS messages that come in from unknown senders. If you go into settings on iOS, go into messages, you can turn on message filtering. There's a little toggle that says filter unknown senders. If you toggle that on, what'll happen is if you get a message from a unknown sender, an SMS, you will not get a notification about that. So you're not going to have a pop-up if that person is not in your contacts already. And that message will be separated in the Messages app into a new tab called Unknown Senders. So at that point, you can look at it, and if it's a legitimate message, you can add that person to your contacts, and then the next time you get an SMS from them, it will go into the regular area. If it's an unknown sender, you can just shuffle it off, delete it, get rid of it. You know it's spam. Now, unfortunately, it doesn't filter out the, I don't know what the word for this is, but you know the little four-digit SMS numbers, so you know, text to this and then you get replies. It does not filter those out. Those still show up in the regular area. And this new message filtering feature actually also supports third-party filters. Now, I've never used any of these. I guess these have been around for a while. A popular one is called Haya. If you have a third-party filter app, message filter app installed, it will show up as an option in this same section. And I think some of the third-party filters maybe give you a little bit more advanced options. So just toggling the thing that I told you about, I think is just a basic setting and something that's built into iOS 11. If you want something a little bit more, if you want something a little more robust, you might look into some of these third-party filters. Again, I'm not familiar with too many of them. If you are, send us some feedback. If you're using one of them and you really like it, if you use Haya, let us know how it works and how you use it. Shoot me an email, an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Another cool tip for tvOS, if you have an Apple TV and you've upgraded to the latest version of tvOS, Matthew found this one, and I thought this was really cool. If you're watching a movie, you probably know if you tap on the remote and you bring up the scrubber, you get the timeline, and at the left-hand side, you have, I think, the start time, or the running time, how far you are into the episode or movie that you're watching, and then you have how much time is remaining over on the right. Well, now with tvOS 4, if you tap the remote, the touch area on your Siri remote again, it will toggle those values, and on the left-hand side, you're going to see the current time, and on the right-hand side, you are going to see the actual end time of the program that you're watching. So, you know, if it's 10:30 p.m. currently, you'll see 10:30 on the left-hand side. And if you have 30 minutes left in your show, you're going to see 11 p.m. as the end time. And I thought that was pretty neat, a handy little feature built into tvOS 4. So check that out. And then last little tip, this one for High Sierra. Gary pointed out with messages, you now have a cool new feature to auto-purge messages, just like you do in iOS. And I'm assuming this feature was added to macOS High Sierra to support the Messages in the Cloud feature when it arrives, hopefully sometime later this year. But if you open up Messages, go into Messages Preferences, and then click on the General tab, you'll see an option for Keep Messages For, and then a drop down where you can set various values. So if you want to have them purged out after a month, you can do that, or you can set it to a year, however long you want to have it auto purge your messages, or you can set it to never if you prefer to keep your messages around until you want to manually remove or delete them. So handy new features and a couple quick tips for iOS 11 and macOS High Sierra. Now, a quick follow-up on something we covered on a past episode of the MacCast. We had a listener who was having some problems with Apple Music and specifically matched tracks. He had added some of his own audio tracks to his iTunes library. He was using Apple Music, and when he would go to play some of the matched tracks, the copies that Apple had up in Apple Music, he was getting some wrong versions. It wasn't necessarily the wrong song, but he might have a live version that he had originally put into his library, and suddenly he was getting the standard radio version, or it was, you know, a rare recording that he had, and he was getting something more commercial from Apple. And several people pointed out that this may just be an issue of when. I think I came up with kind of this convoluted solution that someone had run across where you would try to trick Apple into re-uploading the file into your iCloud music library. But a number of you emailed me and said, nope, Adam, you know, there's a little bit easier way to do this. And actually, this came in from listener Jeff. He said that what he found was it may just be a matter of timing, that early on Apple had some issues with its outmatching algorithm and it didn't quite work for some music tracks, but it now has gotten better. So really what you need to do is you need to force a rematch of those tracks. And the easiest way to do that is go into your iTunes music library and drag the good original local copy that you have, the one that is correct, drag that out onto the desktop or put it somewhere where you can easily find it, because you're going to need to re-add it back to the iTunes library later. Then delete the track that's giving you a problem from the iTunes library, and I'm assuming you want to also remove this from the iCloud music library when it asks you. So basically get it out of iTunes, get it out of Apple Music, make sure that it's not matched or in the cloud. And then once you've done that, re-import that good track from your desktop. And then what should happen is Apple Music should do its thing. It should kick in, try and match that track, reanalyze it. And if it's matched, it will activate the new correct version in your iCloud Music library. If it's not a match, it's going to upload, hopefully, your good version from your iTunes library and put it into your iCloud music library. And at that point, that should resolve the issue. And that makes complete sense to me. Jeff said he's done this for several tracks that he owned and it's fixed it every time. So if you have run into this problem, that could potentially be a fix for you. So that is going to do it for all of the feedback. Let's get into my interview with Peter Cohen. Like I said, a lot of you had questions about iCloud backup, offsite backup for your Mac, specifically in the wake of CrashPlan leaving the personal backup space and going solely into the business backup space. And like I said, Peter has some experience in this area, and he wrote up a great piece on his blog. So I wanted to get him on to talk about this. And we also talked a little bit about doing Mac mini upgrades. So here is my interview with Peter Cohen. Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Good, Adam. How you doing, man?
Hey, it's good to hear from you. Been a while.
Long time no talk, brother.
Yeah, I'm doing great, by the way. I hope you're doing well as also.
it's all unicorns and puppies on my end.
It's all unicorns. That's good. That's always good. Well, I wanted to get you on the show, and I guess it's been a while now. You know, we had the whole fallout with Crash Plan sort of dropping a bomb on a lot of us. My listeners know I've been a Crash Plan fan for a long time and a user. I know a while back you were working with another backup company, online backup company, and you have been writing over at your website and posted what I thought was a really great piece sort of with your take on this. So I wanted to get you on to kind of share that. So I think that the place to start off on this, I think, would be, you know, just your initial reaction, because it kind of just, I think it hit everybody by surprise, right?
Sure. Yeah. So the executive summary here, if you're not keeping score at home, is that CrashPlan, a company that's been offering consumer-based personal cloud backup for a number of years, and whose services, by the way, I've used in the past because they had a really cheap family plan that made total sense for me.
Yeah.
Recently announced that they're getting out of the personal backup business, that they're going to focus specifically on B2B. They're going to focus on the business market. And look, I understand that. As you said, Adam, I used to work for one of their competitors, a company called Backblaze. And the consumer cloud backup business is not growing exponentially. You know, it's not a huge growth market. And I think that Code42, which developed CrashPlan, recognized that and decided to scale back their efforts a little bit. But that leaves people kind of holding the bag. You know, they can go with CrashPlan, they can go with Backblaze, they can go with Carbonite, they can go with a couple of other options, or they can roll their own. You know, if they're neckbeardy and into doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, and, I mean, CrashPlan also has their business services, so people can look at that. But I mean, cost wise, this is where it gets tricky, right?
Right, exactly. And look, you know, especially if you're like a home user and you've got a backup, like, you know, I've got a wife and three kids, and we've all got our own machines, and I want to make sure that they're all well protected. That adds up real quick. You know, that adds up real quick. Mm-hmm. So the basic thesis of my piece, which I pithily called Crash Plan and Burn, I know I'm so impressed with my own sense of humor, is that you shouldn't trust anybody with cloud backup, at least not exclusively. I look at it this way. Cloud backup should be the backup of your backup. So if your primary backup is backing files up to the cloud, and I don't care what you're using, whether it's CrashPlan or whether it's Backblaze or whether it's Dropbox Pro or whether it's iCloud Drive, you know, it doesn't matter. Apple, as much as we love our Apple stuff, should not be trusted exclusively with the integrity of your data. Your data is your responsibility. The integrity of your data is your responsibility. So ultimately, your backup is your responsibility. Now, I like to think of this, when you're developing a backup strategy, as a sort of three-tiered strategy. You've got your live data on your computer. My MacBook Pro is my main daily driver, if you will. It's what I do all my work on. So that's my live copy. That's copy number one. Now, I have a Time Machine backup as well. You know, an external hard disk drive that I connect to my computer every couple of days, and I back it up. And that is a great local backup. The only problem is that Time Machine backups back up to hard disk drives, and hard disk drives are prone to failure over time.
Right.
Eventually, that hard drive might stop working, or something else might happen. I might lose the drive, or heaven forbid, there might be a natural disaster. My house might burn down. It might go totally Donnie Darko, and you know, a jet engine will fall out of the sky and destroy the place, taking my computer and my backup drive with it.
Right.
Well, what am I supposed to do then? That's when having a backup in the cloud comes in so handy. There are other practical examples too. Like, let's say that I'm on the road and I just discovered that 15-page presentation that I'm going to give to the board of directors tomorrow, I just overwrote it because I got to the hotel late and maybe had a couple of cocktails down in the bar and did some stupid stuff in Word.
Right, yeah.
And oh my God, I can't restore from my backup because I don't have it with me. Well, if you've got a copy in the cloud, you can go to that cloud backup and restore that backup when you need it. And you know, that in my other life, you know, working for a backup company, I would hear those stories from our customers all the time. So I know that that's a very real, I'm not making this out of whole cloth. That's something that actually happens to people.
Right.
But when you've got that 3-2-1 backup, that backup of your data in three places, you know, your live copy, your backup, your local backup, and then your online backup, you can be guaranteed that if anything happens, you've got a copy of your data to restore from.
Right.
Now,
this is what you called, I think, in your piece, the 3-2-1, your 3-2-1 philosophy, right?
Right, exactly. It's not mine. You know, this is something that I cribbed, quite frankly, from Backblaze. We wrote about it a lot over there, but I think it's a really good strategy. And I think it's very important to get out to as many people as possible because, in another life, Adam, I used to support Macs and iPhones working mm-hmm. for an Apple-authorized independent reseller and service provider.
Well, and let's be honest, we all continue to do that because of who we are, right? I mean, we have to do it for our friends and our family and our...
Right, like our mutual friend Kelly Guimont so likes to call
your
it.
It's your ongoing life.
It's actually my Sisyphean hell, but right. That's a different story. It's what our mutual friend Kelly Guimont calls family tech support, right? You know, your friends call you up or your family calls you up and says, hey, I know that you're an expert on this stuff and I just spilled Coke on my keyboard. What do I do? Right. Having that 3-2-1 backup idea, I think is so incredibly important and so vital and really helps you guarantee that no matter what happens to your local computer and your local backup, you can have a copy to restore from. Now, I admit, this is a lot of work for a lot of people. And you may be listening to this right now saying to yourself, you know, I don't want to deal with that kind of trouble. I'm happy flying with just one net. Time Machine is good enough for me. And you know what? More power to you. I would rather see you have one backup than no backup.
Yep. I'm in the same camp.
For somebody who lives and dies by the integrity of their data and being able to access it when they need it, I can't possibly imagine life without a multi-tiered backup approach. And I suspect that when it comes right down to it, if you're, you know, doing gainfully employed work on your computer and you're responsible for that computer, you know, if you don't have an IT department to fall back on for this sort of thing, this is something that you should really be giving a lot of thought to.
Yeah. And the three thing too, my listeners are going to know because I just covered this recently. I've always been in that camp and I had to fall back on my cloud backup, unfortunately, recently because my backups of my backups failed. So, you know, and it was through no fault. In this case, particular case, it happened to be some issues with Drobos. I have a couple Drobos and it wasn't the Drobos themselves. It was the fact that I had spinning drives in the Drobos that were, you know, purchased in 2012, and they were all kind of purchased around the same time. And lo and behold, guess what? They all started failing kind of around the same time.
Yeah, funny surprise, how that right? happens, isn't it? Yeah. You know, and if you think about it, hard drives, man, I mean, you know, this is technology that really hasn't changed that much over right. the course of the past 60 years when they were refrigerator sized things. You know, my first job in the industry was about 30 years ago. I was doing tech support for a company called Micronet out in Southern California, and they made hard disk drives, SCSI-based hard disk drives that you would hook up to a Macintosh. So we would put in a Seagate mechanism or a Connor mechanism, and then we would put it in a SCSI chassis, and we would sell it to Mac users. And one of my first days on the job, I took apart a hard disk drive mechanism and looked inside of it. And what I discovered was hard disk drives, just like record players do. Right. You know, there's a little spinning, there's a spindle, there's a central motor, and it spins a disk, and that disk is impregnated with magnetically sensitive material. And that material is written to and read from using a little arm that looks like the arm on a record player. But instead of a needle, it's a very sensitive magnetic device on the end of it. And you fast forward to today, if I took apart the hard drive that I just pulled from my Mac Mini, which we were talking about right before the show started, that hard drive looks basically identical to that one that I took apart 30 years ago. The medium has changed and a lot of the underlying bells and whistles have changed. But, you know, a car in 2017 looks just like a car in 1980. Right. You know, it's got four wheels. It's kind of boxy. Headlights,
if you pull
taillights.
Off all the technology too. You know, the engine's basically the same as well.
Right, exactly. We're still trying to, you know, control explosions. So, you know, hard drives. It's the same kind of story. So this is cheap technology, and it's incredibly powerful technology. But ultimately, it's mechanical technology and subject to entropy, just like everything else in the universe.
Right. Right. And, you know, and then a lot of people will say, well, then just use SSDs, but that doesn't solve the problem either. You know, they are things that will fail too. You know, the one philosophy I always try to remind people about is hard drives. It's not a question of will they fail. It's just when, and you never know.
Not just hard drives, everything.
Right,
everything.
That's true. You know, it's true. Your computer is going to fail eventually also. The case look, that it's in, yeah.
The only things in life that are inevitable are death and taxes, right?
Right.
You know, hard drives are going to die and you do get taxed on their sale.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I thought this was a great sort of piece and something that people should read. Couple follow-up kind of questions I have for you. So what's your current take on, you know, just personally, I know everybody kind of has different methods that they do. My listeners are familiar with mine, but what's your current kind of backup strategy kind of following along your plans?
Well, I have a 2 terabyte Transcend external hard disk drive, a nice portable drive designed to take a lot of abuse because I am hard on my stuff, mm-hmm. That I use for Time Machine backups. And every time I'm in my office, which is every, you know, other day or so, I routinely just hook it up and let it do its thing. So I've got a fairly recent backup. And the nice thing about Time Machine is that, you know, Time Machine keeps track of what's changing in between those sessions and writes all that stuff out to disk when it does it. So it's very clever version control management too.
So the question I have for you there is there a reason why it's not just hooked up all the time? Like I just leave mine always connected when I'm here, obviously. You know, when I come back and or if I'm going on the road, I take my MacBook with me. Obviously, it's just connected. When I get back and hook it back in, I connect it. So I was just curious about that philosophy.
Yeah, because my office is in the basement, so there's no natural light, and the air gets kind of dank down here too. So, you know, I prefer to work from areas where I can get fresh air, and I even sometimes like to be among other humans, and you know, occasionally go out to Starbucks and stuff
just,
like that.
It's just your machine's not typically down there. You've got it mobile. So okay, cool.
Right. So my second layer of defense is a time capsule backup. Now, time capsule is Apple's, I guess, kind of defunct product that enables you to do a time machine backup over your local network. It's essentially just an airport extreme base station with a hard drive built into it. I don't actually have one of those. What I've got is called an IOSafe 214. It is a network attached storage or NAS system that runs the software developed by Synology. So underneath, mechanically, like or electronically, logically, it's actually a two bay Synology NAS. So a DS214 essentially.
Yep.
Not a lot of redundancy, but it gets the job done. And Synology enables you to set that up as a device that's recognized by the Mac on the network as a time capsule backup or a network-based time machine backup. So I do it that way. So
yeah,
that backs
a great
up
option for a lot of people. I do the same thing for my kids' computers. I mean, that's how we get Time Machine backups on them. I happen to have a Synology in this case, but the thought process, the rationale there is that they never connect to anything, right? They ask them to plug in a Time Machine drive or something like that would be just a foreign concept to them.
Right. Now, the reason you're probably scratching your head going, wait a minute, if you've got a Time Machine backup, why are you doing the network-based Time Machine backup? So somewhere along the way in the past few years, I've noticed that occasionally network-based Time Machine backups go wrong.
Right. Yep.
You'll get a message saying, hey, the integrity of your Time Machine backup is messed up. I'm going to have to create a new one. Mm-hmm. And I don't want you to create a new one because I don't want you to lose everything. And there are ways from the command line that you can try to fix it. But what I decided was, you know what, I'm going to have the local backup and I'm going to use the network backup, but I'm not going to rely on the network backup. The advantage of the network backup, though, is that as soon as my Mac is connected to the network on the Wi-Fi, and, you know, Time Machine counts itself down, Time Machine will back up to the network. So I don't really need to think about that one.
Yeah. And that's another, I think, important part. Well, there's two parts to that when it comes to backup, right, is you want to set up a system that is going to be easy enough for you to use that you're going to use it, right?
Yep.
So I think that's an important consideration. The second half of that, though, that I unfortunately a lot of people miss is you also need to check up on it occasionally.
Because
I've been bitten where, you know, I set it and forget it. Well, guess what? Something happened and that forget it part, there's an emergency and you don't have a backup. Now, again, having a, you know, three-tier, I've got it in three places system has always saved me in those cases. So another plug for doing that. But that's another reminder I often try to remind people is like, don't just set it and forget it. You know, put a little tickler in your calendar or whatever it might be. Hey, just double check on that network backup. Make sure that it's still doing what you thought it was doing when you set it up.
So I'm a child of the 80s. I think you're about my age, right?
Yep.
Right, Adam?
Yeah,
absolutely. We're both in our, we're both getting up there, starting to become gray beards in our old age.
Right. Yeah.
But I remember, you know, our president Ronald Reagan meeting with Mikhail Gorbachev in Reykjavik. Mm-hmm. And I remember the catchphrase that he used when they were talking about dismantling the nuclear arsenals was trust but verify.
Right.
There was a Russian phrase that he was borrowing from for that, and he used to like to recite it. And I remember it would like get Gorbachev crazy because he would say it so much. But it's a good principle: trust but verify. Once you've got your system set up, don't assume that that system works flawlessly. It is very important as part of your backup strategy to periodically examine the material that's being backed up and the workflow that you've created to make sure that it's working right. And what I mean by that is you need to not only verify that your backups are happening, but you need to restore files from your backup to make sure that the integrity of that data is maintained. This is as important for a local backup as it is for a cloud backup.
Yep. Yeah, and the other thing somewhat related to that, especially with cloud backup that I've discovered over the years, is, you know, when you originally set it up, you may have set it up in a certain way to back up certain files and folders and things like that. Well, guess what? You use your machine and you may have added new important things, right? That one's bit me too, especially with my cloud backup, where I've set it up, you know, a bunch of folders, and then a new project comes along, I set up some folder, and I don't realize I've got it in a place where it's not being backed up to the cloud, right? Because I didn't set it up that way, because I don't want to back up everything to the cloud. So I've been selective. So just another thing to remind people about.
Exactly. I mean, you know, if you're on tiered service, if you have a bandwidth cap, like many of us do, Comcast, you know, it can be a real issue. If you just back up everything willy nilly, it's sometimes a lot smarter to create what are called exclusion lists and exclude specific directories or specific volumes that are connected to your computer, so those don't get backed up.
Right.
So that's definitely part of it. And then Adam, just to answer the question. That you answered originally, for offline store or for offsite storage,
mm-hmm.
I still use Backblaze, even though I don't work there anymore. I'm a big believer in their product, and they offer the best bang for the buck. So I've got my computer set up with personal backup through Backblaze. So you know, that way I've got everything. And you know what? I also understand that some stuff is just kind of backed up seamlessly to the cloud, like iCloud Drive. I use on all my computers to synchronize my desktop and also to offload files that I don't access frequently. So I've got more space because, three of my computers now are all equipped with SSDs. So internal storage capacity is kind of at a premium. And I'm a digital pack rat. I've been, you know, collecting digital files for the last 30 years. So I've got a lot of stuff. But on top of that, you know, it Apple really kind of makes it easy for you to not think about, like, you know, where are all my photos? Where are, you know, where's my contacts? Where's that stuff? So I have to admit, I rely on iCloud just like so many of us do. And that's kind of, you know, cloud-based backup too. But I supplement all that with local
okay.
backup.
So that was... So that was kind of the follow. So that's a perfect lead in, because that was the final question I wanted to ask you about all of this, because this is something that I'm starting to struggle with. And I think a lot of people are, you know, things like iCloud, things like Dropbox, both services that I use and I love. I use iCloud Drive. I use Dropbox. I put stuff there. Obviously, with those services, I always make sure or photos in the cloud, right? Or iCloud Photo Library, I guess is what it's called.
Whatever appellation Apple
right.
has come up
so
with this
with
week.
All of those systems, you know, those are syncing systems. So there's a local copy of everything somewhere. And I'm making sure that that is part of that, you know, triple tier backup strategy that I have. So in a lot of ways, I look at those cloud storage places as almost like a fourth tier of backup, right? It's a fourth place where I have those files and things like that. And those are outside of my control. The question that I want to get to with you is, it seems like more and more that Apple and some of these companies are actually removing our ability to, like, they're saying, oh, just give everything to us. We'll store it in the cloud. We'll take care of it for you. And they're not even giving us an option to have local versions of those, right? It's just like, oh, this will be in the cloud. Just, you know, you can pull it down when you need it. And most specifically, most recently, my example of that is, you know, the removal of apps and the App Store from iTunes 12.7, right? Part of my backup strategy, I use ChronoSync to back up my my media, you know, files from iTunes. And part of those media files has always been the mobile apps. Because guess what? App developers pull apps that still work or whatever. And so I've always had a strategy where I keep a copy of every, like, IPA file ever from iTunes. And now with this change, Apple has sort of said, nope, you don't need to worry about that. We have copies of all these apps. You don't need to store copies of them. If you need them again, you can just download them from us. And that kind of freaks me out a little bit, right?
Nerd.
But this is a little bit about what we're talking about, right? You want to be in control and backing up all of your stuff. And even Apple themselves, with, like, movies and TV shows, have always told us that, hey, if you buy a TV show on iTunes, we don't guarantee that we're always going to have a copy of it. You better make sure you back it up. It's in their support articles. And yet here's a situation where they're kind of pulling that capability away from consumers. And I worry about them starting to do that with things like iCloud Photo. You know, and they're not doing it now, but it seems like we're moving down this trajectory with a lot of these services where they're saying, nope, look, we're going to take care of the cloud, and you can just have all your stuff in the cloud and you don't need to worry about it. And that freaks me out a little bit.
Anytime I feel like I'm being told, don't worry your pretty little head about it, honey, I get really concerned, because that's when I start worrying.
Right.
You know, so I completely agree with you, Adam. And, you know, I think that what you're talking about ultimately, and, you know, at the risk of sort of going off on a philosophical tangent here, is that, you know, with all of these modern devices and all of the ecosystems that we're bought into, whether we're Android users or whether we're iPhone users or you know, whether we roll our own stuff or whether we rely on commercial cloud services, is you know, this sort of tension between security and, on one hand, the security of having our data backed up locally, the security of being able to take care of itself ourselves, and quite frankly, the security of the personal responsibility of making sure that happens.
Right.
Compared to the convenience of letting somebody else worry about it. And the problem when you let somebody else worry about it is that if there is a problem with what they're doing or how they're doing it, you often have no recourse to affect change that gets you to where you need to go. And I've seen this countless times, you know, supporting users with these devices who maybe didn't understand quite how the technology worked and thought that iCloud, having an iCloud account, was the same as backing up my computer. And
right.
What do you mean all my files are lost? Or, well, I used that time machine thing once. Isn't that enough? Like 3 years ago, and now my computer's broken. Well, all of your files since then are lost. Well, why is that? You know, well, because there's a difference between, you know, actual the way the computers work and magic, and, you know, a hard drive isn't magically going to back up your computer if it's not connected to it.
Right.
But these are intricacies. You know, it frustrates me because, like, I love driving my Jeep around, but I don't pretend to understand how most of the parts on it work, right? I rely on my mechanic to tell me when things go wrong, and I trust that he's not jerking me around.
Right.
When he tells me that, you know, my ball joint on my passenger side needs to get replaced because, you know, it's creating problems and that's what's making that knocking noise every time you go around a corner. Well, okay, I'll take it for granted that he's not trying to rip me off and that he's really, you know, diagnosed that properly. He's a good guy. I've been doing business with him for a long time. Most of us are like that when it comes to computers. You know, they're black boxes or phones. They're black boxes that get my email online and let me talk on the phone to people or let me look at pictures of grandkids. We don't necessarily understand all of the underlying technology and services that go into how they work. So when those services go wrong, that's when all of a sudden we realize, holy cow, there's a lot of stuff I didn't know that I probably should have. And that's why I think it's so important to be mindful of this stuff and just make sure that you're doing everything you can to take care of it yourself.
Right. And share that information with your non-tech people, I think, is the last thing I would add to that. You know, it's like we are all in that position, and I'm doing the proverbial we, including the audience, because a lot, you know, most people that listen to this podcast are very technical and are that family tech support. So, you know, help everybody out so that we don't fall down these traps of all my files are gone, or where all my photos of my kids for the last 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a platitude, but, you know, teach a man to fish and all that, you know.
Right.
It's better to help everybody else become self-reliant on this stuff. It'll work out well for all of us in the long run if you can help
people. All right, cool. Thank you for sharing that. Now, there's one other thing I want to take maybe 10 more minutes of your time. This one's a little bit more selfish, because I noticed you also wrote another piece on your site recently about an issue I'm having in my own household. So I bought a 2014 Mac Mini for my wife as an upgrade.
My condolences.
For a 2009 iMac. And it's been a struggle. And just literally, I think yesterday she said to me, this is the slowest computer I've ever had. It's slower than my old one. What the heck is going on? And I'm kind of getting it. And I've known for a while what I thought the issue and probable resolution is. And lo and behold, I look on your website and you go, hey, I just put an SSD in my 2014 iMac, and that's helped, right? So
yeah,
I just want to get your take on that, that experience.
So, you know what? I'm going to take this in a little bit of a different direction, Adam. And let me just say at the outset that if you've got an older Mac that you're ready to throw out because it's not running fast enough, if the thing works well and you would like it except for the speed issue,
yep,
and it's working with a spinning hard drive, think about replacing it with an SSD.
Yep.
If it's upgradable to an SSD, it's really probably worth doing. The exception for this are the really old deprecated machines, what Apple euphemistically calls vintage computers. Mm-hmm. Those are computers that you can't get parts for anymore. Those are computers that are no longer updated with modern versions of the operating system and may in fact be so old that Apple's not even really doing security patches for them anymore. Those computers I'd leave behind, simply because as time goes on, it's going to get tougher and tougher even just to keep those things online, because you're not going to be able to run versions of Safari or Firefox or Chrome or whatever it is that you want to do with them online, because they're just so old. Now, I'm talking about 10-year-old computers, but whatever.
Sure, yeah.
Anyway, just like you, Adam, I have a Mac Mini from 2014. Now, 2014 was a big year for the Mac Mini. Apple refreshed it after leaving it kind of languid for a couple of years, I guess you could say. And that year, they did something really interesting. They replaced they upgraded the CPU on it. And they also updated the main logic board design, so you can't upgrade the RAM on them anymore. So
right,
all of us are probably either stuck with 4 or maybe 8 gigabytes of RAM.
On mine, I went for the top of the line, but yeah,
I was cheap. I went for the 499 model, and the problem with the 499 model is, and you know, the interesting thing is, 4 gigabytes of RAM and 1.4 gigahertz processor was the 499 model. That was actually the same base spec as the MacBook Air that year.
Right.
The difference is that Apple put a spinning hard disk drive in, because the cost per gigabyte on spinning drives is still, to this day, so much lower than an SSD is. And, you know, the Mac Mini is a fairly low volume, fairly small margin device for Apple. So Apple's trying to keep it as cheap as possible. Mm-hmm. The difference between 4 gigs of RAM and 1.4 gigahertz with a hard drive and 4 gigabytes of RAM and 1.4 gigahertz with SSD is huge. And the reason for that is because you know, Mac OS X is a modern operating system based on Unix. It does a lot of virtual memory paging and swap outs. So, you know, when you start it up, a lot of stuff loads into memory. The computer will start firing those memory files out to disk as swap files, and then we'll read that stuff back in. Well, when you're dealing with a spinning hard drive, that's your bottleneck right there, because all that stuff needs to get written out. All that stuff needs to get read back in. It takes a long time to do it. SSDs don't have any moving parts. They're just memory chips. So that stuff goes really rapid fire. And even though you're working on the same slow serial ATA or SATA interface, the physical impediment of the drive having to read and write off the spinning stuff is gone. And the difference in my Mac Mini is like night and day. I don't get the beach balls spinning anymore when I open two or three applications. I don't have to wait 3 minutes for it to start up. It starts up lickety-split. It switches between applications. It wakes from sleep right away. It is peppy as heck. Now, I've done this upgrade on a 2009 MacBook Pro, like an old – yep. You know, the old style pre-Retina MacBook Pro. I've done it on two old polycarbonate unibody MacBooks, the white ones.
Right.
And I've also done it on I've also upgraded the SSD in an old MacBook Air. And in every case, I can't tell you how improved the performance has been. It's been like night and day. Yeah, if your computer can take additional RAM, not like the 2014 Mac Mini, that's another good upgrade to do. But the SSD, single probably biggest performance boost I can think for any older Mac, and they're cheap. Now, look, it's going to be easier for some people to open these up and take them apart than others. I basically did mine in the course of a morning. And one of the things that tripped me up on the 2014 Mac Mini in particular is that Apple switched the bottom to Torx security screws, which are different than regular Torx screws. Right. So I actually needed to get a different tool set. iFixit was nice enough to send me one.
Yep.
It worked out very well. It had all the parts that I needed. Getting around it was a little tricky. There are very small parts that you have to disconnect and then reconnect. My one sort of off-the-wall piece of advice to anybody doing this, regardless of which machine that you're taking apart, is use your iPhone to take photos of the screws that you remove and their placement, because it's really easy to get them jumbled up, even if you're putting them on like a mat or even like maybe down on a piece of sticky tape or masking tape to not lose them.
Right.
You might forget where they go, so it's nice to have a visual sense of, oh, that screw goes in that hole there, even though it looks like it'll fit in this other one here. You know that
that's
it's there.
That's good advice, yeah.
But no, it was a real, real great upgrade. I'm very happy I did it.
So the only – you kind of answered everything for me. This is something I have known for a long time I need to do. And the irony is I had done a 500 gigabyte SSD upgrade to my 2011 MacBook Pro, which died. So I actually have the SSD drive already sitting around.
I did too, yeah.
My fear has been every time I look at the teardown for that Mac Mini has been the remove, because you basically have to remove the whole board from the case. I think there's a point where you twist the power supply and that comes out, but then you have to sort of pop the board out, and there's this special tool, right, that they say you need, or you can do this weird bent wire hanger thing. But what I was excited about your piece is you mentioned that you didn't have to do that. So what's the trick and what's the gotchas if you don't have one of those tools? That's my final question to you.
Okay, so on the 2014, and we're really going into the inside baseball weeds.
Well, because I think people other people I'm sure who have 2014 Mac Minis and like me have considered this. I think they're probably on the same road. I have not done it mainly because it's just like my fear of like I don't want to have to go get a special tool and deal with it. It's too much of a pain in the butt.
Right, exactly. If you've got a wire coat hanger, you can make one in about 3 minutes. You know, a wire coat hanger, and you don't even need like a crimping tool or anything. You can just bend it into place and do it. I don't. We switched to, you know, it's right. Not like we're mommy dearest around here or anything, but we switched to plastic coat hangers just because we didn't like the way that our stuff hangs on the wire ones.
Yep.
And they do sell, like even iFixit sells a $5 tool custom made for this purpose. But if you check the motherboard on not only the 2014 Mac Mini, but I think also the 2012, there are a couple of holes that aren't occupied by screws or any other device. The special tool or your bent coat hanger goes in there, and you use it to kind of move the motherboard along. I found it was totally optional. Once I had everything disconnected and ready to go, I was just able to apply pressure using both thumbs in that approximate area and slide it backwards. I had to kind of wedge my thumbs up between the main logic board and the
It's like the exterior case, right?
No, it's actually the vents.
Okay.
Because you know there's a fan inside there, and then there are vents that let air move through, and I was kind of pushing on my thumbs against the main logic board and close to those vents, and I was able to just pop it right out as a result.
So is it sort of a down and out kind of pressure? That's what it always looked like to me on one of those little screw hole areas. Am I getting that right, or?
There isn't a specific downward motion associated with it, but yeah, you're pressing down in that you're trying to get some leverage.
Okay.
And then you push out, and that assembly comes out, and then you have to detach the hard disk drive from a sub assembly that's in there, you do that with four screws and so on. But
deep into the weeds. I would recommend people look at the iFixit guide, which I think is really pretty good. But yeah, that was the one tricky part that I was curious about. So I was kind of, am I going to do this weekend, or am I going to go on iFixit and order a tool? And it sounds like I may be able to do it without having to order the tool.
Your mileage may vary, obviously, and I take absolutely no responsibility if you mess things up. But my experience was that I did not need that tool, and judging from some of the other upgrade videos that I watched before I actually did it, it seems to be kind of a 50-50 thing. Some people doing teardowns swear by the tool or swear by making the tool. Others are like, I know you don't need the tool, guys. You can do this with your fingers, and that's actually what gave me the idea.
Okay, cool. I'll do my own research, and what I do to my own machines is my responsibility, and I will say the same thing for anybody else tearing down machines and trying to replace your own parts. You know your comfort level, and if you're not comfortable, that's my advice is if you get in there and you suddenly feel not comfortable, stop what you're doing, back out, and find somebody who is comfortable. Do it.
What's the expression about, you know, when you find yourself, you know, inside of a hole, stop digging?
Yep, exactly. Exactly. Or just know the risk that you're about to embark on, and don't blame someone else for your mess up. So
yeah, having said that, don't be scared of it either. I mean, you know,
I'm not
I read so much FUD about the 2014 Mac Mini being so unupgradable and so user hostile. I really didn't find that was the case at all. I understand the design trade-offs that Apple made for it. And sure, yeah, it's a little bit more difficult to work on than, let's say, my 2010 Mac Mini or the 2009 that I upgraded back in the day. But all things being equal, I can't really say that it was like the worst. You know, it's not like taking apart, like, let's say, a Retina MacBook Pro, which really is not a user serviceable device. You know, there's nothing in there that people can really work on themselves very easily. This was a different story. You know, this is a computer that's designed to be in as few pieces as possible for production reasons. And, you know, Apple made it not great to work on, but didn't, you know, it's not like, you know, punji sticks are going to get jabbed into your, under your fingernails or something as soon as you open it up.
All right, cool. Well, thanks for giving me a little inspiration and guidance there. And certainly thank you for coming on and talking with us for about 40 minutes here. I appreciate your time. Finally, you want to just let people know kind of what you're up to, where they can find out what you're doing, maybe check out those posts that I mentioned along with some of the other stuff that you're writing?
You bet, yeah. So right now I'm freelancing. So the best place to find me, if you're interested in reading stuff that I'm writing, is at my own website, which is at peter-cohen.com. And any interesting stuff that I do, like the show, will be linked out to that from there as well. You can also find me on Twitter at Flarg, FLARGH. Only warning that I would give folks is that I tend to work blue. I'm NSFW. And I have a lot of opinions, and I'm very prone to verbal diarrhea. But there's also some good tech insight and just general snark about the tech industry there too. So that's another great place to find me.
Cool. Well, I follow you and have for years, so it's great stuff. And again, thanks for coming on.
Likewise, Adam. Thank you so much for having me, man. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
There you go, Peter Cohen, with some great advice and tips and things related to not only doing Mac Mini upgrades, but your backups as well. And I appreciate him taking the time to come on and chat with me. If you are not following him on Twitter or you're not following his blog, I encourage you to check it out. He is a smart guy and knows his stuff. So well worth the follow. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. I have one little thing, extra thing to talk to you about, especially if you are a podcaster, if you're anywhere near Arizona at all. I just got invited to a workshop, an event that I am going to be attending called the Podcast It Yourself Workshop. This is in conjunction with the Podcasting for Dummies third edition release. I got a little promo for you. Here's what's going on, and then a few comments about it here in a second.
Interested in starting a podcast? Then be sure to attend PIY 2017. PIY is the Podcast It Yourself Workshop, October 28th in Phoenix, Arizona. Learn about software, hardware, accessories, best practices, and more to make your podcast rock. Need more information? We'll have the authors of Podcasting for Dummies 3rd Edition, T. Morris and Chuck Tomasi, on hand to answer questions and sign books. Spaces are limited, so go to podcastingfordummies.com and sign up for PIY 2017. We look forward to seeing you there.
So if you want to learn about podcasting, if you're wondering where to start, if you're already a podcaster and you just want to kind of learn from other podcasters who have been around for a while, I think this should be a really fun event with some great, what I'm going to call founding podcasters. I don't want to call us the grandfathers of podcasting, which we probably really are. Chuck Tomasi and T. Morris were around in the early days with me back in 2004 when there weren't a whole bunch of us doing this. So lots of knowledge that you can tap into if you're looking for something fun to do toward the end of October related to podcasting. You should check it out. It's only $20 for a 4-hour workshop. It is a great deal. And I'd love to see you there. So head to podcastingfordummies.com and sign up for the PIY 2017 event. And I look forward to seeing you in Phoenix. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for your iOS devices and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by heading to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your emails and audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. Or if you're on Google Plus, check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusmaccast. That'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.